Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how the politics of memory and memory entrepreneurs are trying to shape what and how we remember the past as a means of shaping the future. But first, art as an act of resistance and as a weapon to counter oppression and violence. With us is Mark Levine. He's a professor of history at the University of California at Irvine and the author of Overthrowing Geography, Heavy Metal Islam, and Impossible Peace. Well, welcome back to the Scholar's Circle, Mark Levine. It's great to have you back with us.
Wonderful to be there.
You have written this piece about art as a weapon of resistance, particularly in certain times, and you use this Nigerian artist sort of as the lead-in to give us an example. Could you remind us of who this artist is and how this illustrates your point?
You mean Fela Kuti's art?
Yes.
Well, the inspiration for the research I've been doing the last 5 years really was Fela Kuti. Fela Kuti is probably the most important popular music artist in the 20th century in Africa. He was, not only the most famous musician in Africa in the, in the 1970s and 80s and 90s, and he was based in Lagos in Nigeria. But he also was by far the most political artist, perhaps, in the world. He came to the U.S. in the late 60s, was introduced to the Black Panthers, and became highly politicized. He came from a political family himself, and came home and just made a series of albums with and songs with titles like Zombie, Thief Thief, No Agreement, and the list goes on and on, each one more political than the next. And this is against a government, a Nigerian dictatorship, which was one of the most brutal on earth, and which in the late 60s had engaged in a genocidal war against the Biafran people. I'm sure many of your older listeners remember the Biafran War, which killed, just to put it in perspective, it killed 3 million people in the same time that the Syrian civil war has killed about 200,000. Mm. So it was on a whole other level of death and destruction. And he was willing to take on this government directly, and he coined a phrase which really moved me and which I put on the front cover of my book, Heavy Metal Islam, which was that music is the weapon of the future. So Fela Kuti, had this idea of music as the weapon of the future, although for him it was actually a weapon of the present, and it cost him dearly. At one point, the Nigerian military raided his home, threw his mother out the second-story window and killed her. And rather than being cowed, he took his mother's coffin and marched it to the home of the president and took a photo of it and wrote a song called Coffin for Head of State, which then also became the title of one of his albums. So that's the kind of person he was. And he was truly one of the great artists in African musical history, certainly modern musical history. And this really inspired me as I was working with artists in the Arab world and Iran and Pakistan and Turkey in the late 90s and 2000s, and starting to see their musical scenes being politicized, especially rock music, hip-hop, these kinds of musics. And once the revolutions broke out across the Arab world, it really became clear how important music was, and that it had become not a music of the future, not a weapon of the future, but a weapon clearly of the present. And in fact, just this past month, I was in Nigeria again, in the Niger Delta, which has suffered such devastation from oil spills and other environmental damage of the petroleum industry. And I was talking to a young rapper named MCK, literally along the riverbank of one of the most devastated rivers in this place called Ogoniland, the Ogoni Kingdom. And he was saying the same thing. We were talking about Fela, who, of course, is an inspiration for any young Nigerian artist. And he was saying the same thing, that music, it really has become the weapon of the present. It's the only weapon that young artists have left, music, art, poetry, etc. So that's the kind of work that I've been trying to focus on, to study and collaborate with these artists who are really at the edge of intense social and political and economic conflict, and who are trying to use this art not just as a weapon of resistance against authoritarian regimes or corruption or, exploitative corporations like oil companies, but also as a tool of creating new communities and new solidarities that are very important for long-term struggle.
Now, one of the things you noted in the article was that some of these regimes have really tried to suppress and oppress art and music in some pretty heinous ways as well.
Well, I mean, if you look at the revolutions in the Arab world, let's just start with them. You know, some of my friends, for example, the Moroccan rapper Al-Haqid, have been jailed multiple times, beaten, tortured, you know, denied their rights, clearly on trumped-up charges, framed for crimes they clearly didn't commit. In Egypt, artists have been, again, tortured, beaten, forced into exile. In Syria, artists have had their hands smashed, their throats slit, depending on what kind of art they do. So a sculptor might have his hands smashed. A singer and poet had his throat slit, obviously killed. You know, in Mali and in other places where ISIL-like groups have been running rampant the last few years, artists have been stoned and killed and, of course, musical instruments destroyed. So it's you know, artists have suffered, you know, severe threats, not just musicians, although as a musician, those are the people I most focus on, but writers as well are under severe threat. And especially these days, whether you're in Africa or in the Middle East, which are the two places I look at, you don't know who's going to get you first. Is it a repressive government or, you know, or a violent, religiously based insurgency? And sometimes it's both, especially in a place like Syria. You really are at the mercy of you don't know who. Libya is similar. So it's really become almost unprecedentedly difficult to be an artist that is trying to work for social and political change today.
And you mentioned the religious groups as well. Part of your point in that article had to do with how religion and music, at their best, really have this transcendent quality. But then there's this kind of competition as well. How would you describe that?
Yeah, that's a very good point. You know, one of the things I realized when I was, this I realized around 2004 when I was in Iraq. I was in Iraq after the U.S. invasion doing research as far away from the green zone and the embedded kind of scholars and reporters as possible with, you know, interviewing insurgents and religious leaders and just trying to understand in an unfiltered way what was actually happening in Iraq. And I realized quickly that most of these people that I was supposed to be interviewing were very boring. And in fact, I could pretty much write down what they were going to say before they even said it, because they had a very narrow kind of company line that they would repeat. And the most interesting people who were always surprising me were, of course, the artists who I'd meet at night in cafes or people's homes or very occasionally a performance somewhere. Underground performance, and that's when I really, you know, became aware of the fact that rather than just focusing on the usual suspects, I could actually learn a lot more about what was going on in a place by hanging out with the people I enjoyed being with, which was the artists. And as I got to know more and more artists, I became friends with a very well-known singer and guitarist named Salman Ahmed from the band Janoon, which is perhaps the most popular at its heyday in the 90s, was the most popular group in the world east of Istanbul. They are a Pakistani rock band that sold 30 million albums and, you know, were very, very well known across Asia. And he did a wonderful documentary for MTV called The Rock Star and the Mullah, where he traveled around Pakistan with his guitar and would go to madrasas and mosques and play music and challenge the imams and you know, these kind of very, very extreme conservatively religious madrasas to understand that music was not prohibited, essentially in the Quran. That was a human decision, not one that was dictated by God. And of course, he received all kinds of death threats and attacks because of it. But he said something really interesting to me. He said, you know, the reason they don't like us is because we are their competition. Because in the end, you know, rock and roll and intense, beautiful music that is liberating for young people is a direct competitor in a situation of hopelessness with a kind of nihilistic but also extremely intense and emotionalized and highly effective religious practice. And he wasn't the only one who said this. Even in Iraq, I would meet especially one young religious sheikh who was very progressive, who we had a long discussion about rock music, and he said the same thing. When we as religious people are marching and, you know, pumping our fists on our chests and chanting and pumping them in the air and banging drums, he said, we're doing heavy metal too. It's the same thing. It reaches the same place. So it became clear that, you know, music and religion, which of course have gone together since the beginning of both, also, depending on who's doing it, can be directly competitive. And that is why I think in so many places where you have these extreme religious movements, they are very against any kind of music that they don't control. It's not necessarily that they're against music, because most of them have their own music. But any other kind of music, especially a so-called secular music or a Sufi music, which is not advocating violence, can direct people's attention and their loyalty away from this very extremist path, and so they are a threat. And that also is something you have to take into consideration when you're studying these kinds of movements, how music and religion, or art and religion, intersect and compete at the same time.
So these are a couple of the forces that you've been studying, and you brought in some other forces in this article that were also interacting with the politics and the music and the religion, and that was globalization, neoliberalism, colonialism. How do these interact with these other forces?
Well, first of all, I think we need to also talk about, you know, what the definition of religion is, right? My definition of religion, I follow Paul Tillich, the great Protestant theologian, who basically described religion as whatever is of ultimate concern to a person. And I think that much broader understanding of what religion is allows for us to understand why something like music, or of course a seemingly irreligious or non-religious ideology like communism or, you know, worshiping money or whatever, can also fulfill the same function sociologically, psychologically, spiritually, epistemologically, or phenomenologically as religion. So that kind of broader understanding of the role of religion, I think, is very important for us to bear in mind. But, these other forces, I mean, globalization, or what we would call today neoliberalism, as the form that globalization takes, of course, is, you know, almost overdetermines the way art gets done today. It does so in a negative way, on the one hand, because the new technologies, the internet and social media and satellite TV and mobile phones, allow for an inundation of local cultures by the globally dominant Western cultures. This was something that was a huge threat, again, to critics of the West, especially to religious conservatives. Of course, even in France, they were very scared of this and took a lot of measures in the 90s to try to protect France and French culture and language from globalization and what they thought was going to be Americanization. So it's not unique to the developing world or to the Muslim world. It's happened in many other places in the so-called first world or the developed world as well. But it also, you know, I think the focus that a lot of people have given to the negative components of globalization, especially culturally, overshadow what in fact are the many positive dynamics. And for, you know, so many people in these cultures, they have fully indigenized these other cultural forms that travel through and travel in. And in fact, American culture has not necessarily been the dominant form. We see all over Africa and the Arab world, Bollywood being extremely important. We see Japanese culture being very important, everything from manga to anime and other forms that have taken root elsewhere. And you know, all cultures, no matter how much people want to claim a specific culture as pure or as their own or as indigenous or autochthonous to a specific place, of course, in reality, culture is extremely hybrid. There is no pure culture. That's essentially, a fiction. And so most people have adapted culture continuously going back thousands of years and done so very happily and with great affect and with great effect. So, you know, culture has had a lot of, you know, has been one of the most positive, in some places the only positive, impact of globalization. Just to give you an example, again, a couple of weeks ago I'm standing in the Niger Delta with a young rapper who pulls out a song on his cell phone that he just wrote on his computer with his partner, a computer that 10 years ago would have cost, you know, innumerable thousands of dollars, way beyond the reach of any young person in his part of Nigeria, in a poor fishing village in Nigeria. And, you know, with a software downloaded for free from the internet, they recorded a song which sounds as good as any song recorded by, you know, professionally for thousands and thousands of dollars, and the song was uploaded onto the internet and circulated for free and was a hit, a local hit, and it was a very political song. The song was called January Money, and it was about the corruption that plagues his region in the Niger Delta and has prevented the proper cleanup from the oil spill. And all of these technologies and this ability to produce, disseminate, and consume culture freely, essentially, from anywhere to anywhere, is one of the most amazing blessings of globalization. It has helped create communications across, you know, not just a cultural divide, but continental divides. So culture, neoliberalism, while the economic impact is certainly negative for most peoples, especially peoples in the developing world or in the West, if you're not part of the 1% or 2%, it also offers tools of resistance and transcendence that weren't available decades ago, even a few decades ago. So those who are most active on the ground are cognizant of this and are trying to use the tools that neoliberalism has provided, in the sense that it doesn't necessarily weaken states, but it shifts the way power operates in states and does offer some new forms of resistance, even as it offers new forms of repression for states. And the battle, you know, as Gramsci, of course, told us would happen, the war of position just shifts constantly to new terrain. And, you know, those who are at the forefront of pushing for cultural change are you know, the real warriors today. They are the ones who are really helping to produce, to keep the battle going, even though the odds are so stacked in favor of those who have state power or the power of capital behind them. And that's, you know, that's what gives me hope.
One of the things you also wrote about was the specific art in Tahrir Square and how partly the protest itself was a form of art, and that it was helping to create this solidarity and perhaps giving hope to a generation. And this was in the face of the oppression. So what would you, how would you describe this?
Certainly, Tahrir Square was perhaps one of the world's largest ever installation art pieces when it was really cooking. You know, when you'd go in there, and I was lucky enough to be there for much of the revolution, the January 25th revolution, you would just be bombarded with every kind of aesthetic product imaginable. You would hear drums banging, people singing, people chanting, posters everywhere, photos everywhere, cartoons everywhere, people, you know, delivering speeches, movies being shown on sheets from, you know, cheap projectors, and you know, stages every 10 or 12 meters with someone else singing a different kind of music, and just on, and everyone videotaping and then producing their own videos, and they get disseminated, and it was overwhelming. You know, by the time you'd spend 7, 8, 10, 12 hours a day in Tahrir, your head was swimming. And that is what made Tahrir impregnable, in a sense. As long as there was that much art, it meant there were that many people, and as long as there were that many people, the government could not just start bombing or killing or shooting. That was absolutely the key. So art was central to the power of Tahrir Square at that moment, and perhaps the most important space in Tahrir, to me, which hardly anyone has written about, was right outside, ironically, the KFC restaurant. There's a couple of Western fast food places in Tahrir, KFC and Hardee's. And the KFC had something called the Revolutionary Artists Union located outside, which was a section of the square, maybe 10 meters by 10 meters, where all the artists came to do their art and put it up and do caricatures, and poets would come and do poetry, musicians would come and do music. And it was just, and this was 24 hours a day, it was just an absolutely, you know, enthralling place as an artist to be. And I met many wonderful people I still stay in touch with there. But art on its own can't lead. I don't want to romanticize the power of art. Art is a very strange thing because it both reflects and can help lead movements of change, but it can't do it in the absence of the people who are there, who have to be in the physical space to make it work. So gradually, over the next 2 years, as the revolution slowly lost momentum and Tahrir began to be filled with other people, with Salafis and Muslim Brotherhood members, and then pro-military people finally with the coup in 2013, the art essentially disappeared. And, you know, the last time Tahrir was occupied in any meaningful sense around the, which was by the pro-coup people who thought they were engaged in a new revolution, but most were duped. The reason you knew they were going to be duped, if you knew how to look, was because there was simply no art there, except for banners supporting Sisi, supporting the military, and a very ugly and ramshackle little museum in dedication to Gamal Nasser, the famous leader of the 1952 coup who led Egypt from then until 1970 when he died. And, you know, that utter lack of art, and the fact that the great art and music that was being produced was suddenly replaced by really cheesy music and cheesy art in celebration of the very military against whom people revolted 2 years earlier, demonstrated, you know, how far Egypt had descended from the height of the revolutionary period. So I think art, you know, becomes both a kind of canary in the coal mine for the revolutionary pulse, but it also has a synergizing and amplifying effect. And the more that's there, the more it helps solidify and increase a revolutionary moment, which then generates more art. So it's a very useful tool of analysis, but you need very finely calibrated intellectual instruments to correctly understand its role and power.
Mark Levine, before we let you go now, if you could give us a bit of update, because you've been traveling quite a bit. You mentioned that you'd been in Nigeria and Kenya and Sweden, but also Tunisia. And you had posted on your Facebook page about some of the refugees that you had crossed paths with in airports and in other settings. One in particular who wanted to show you a video on his phone of ISIS executing his brother.
Yeah, this was very tragic. This was in Malmo, in southern Sweden, which is right across the strait from Copenhagen. It is basically the point where hundreds of thousands, or tens of thousands at least, of refugees have entered Sweden, one of the main places. Some come overland in the north, but that's very rare. Most have come through Germany, and then into Denmark, and then the train into southern Sweden. And, you know, some days, and Malmo is third or fourth biggest town in Sweden, but it still means it's only a few hundred thousand people at most. You know, it's getting as many as 1,700 people a day showing up. And you know, the way the Swedes have handled this is just amazing and inspiring. Nevertheless, you know, at 12:30 at night, if sometimes I wander in to see what's happening, and there'll be 100, 200 people still sleeping there because there's simply nowhere for them to go. They can't move anywhere yet, and you know, it's a safe space. It's dry in the train station, and there are people there from various volunteer organizations who help find housing, and the government who help lead them to processing centers. But it takes time, and I met one family there, a man who was there with his daughters from Mosul, and of course Mosul was taken over by ISIS a year and a half or so ago. And they killed anyone who was an activist in the most brutal way. And he, according to him, I don't know if this is true, you know, was in Mosul a very wealthy person who owned several gas stations and such. And to punish him for not supporting them, they basically killed his brother in front of him. And, you know, he pulled out his cell phone and wanted to show this to me. And, of course, I didn't need to see another execution video by ISIL, and he understood. But, you know, he keeps it with him because that's his story. And obviously when he finally gets to a refugee processing center, as an Iraqi, he is not guaranteed immediate asylum, whereas any Syrian who gets to Sweden has essentially been promised asylum. They are the only ones, though, and a lot of people don't understand that. So, in fact, most of the people arriving are Afghans, the majority of whom will probably be sent back to Afghanistan. The rest are Iraqis, and if you don't come from one of the parts of Iraq that are under ISIL control right now, like Mosul or Ramadi or Fallujah, you will, or Suleimania maybe, you will be sent back too, because they simply can't handle everyone coming in. And really, Syrians are the only ones who get in. But because he's from Mosul, and because he has this video and other evidence, he'll probably get asylum in Sweden. I met people from Eritrea, people from Egypt. You know, everyone is coming right now because they think they can. And some are clearly war refugees. Some are not war refugees, but they're political exiles. I'm working with, you know, a young man I met there from Syria. While he's Syrian, he's from Damascus, and he wasn't really under immediate threat from Damascus. So he really isn't a refugee, but he came because he had the chance to come. He took a very arduous boat that could have killed him, like we've seen with so many people, but he made it. And, you know, now he has a job, he's learned Swedish, he's restarted his life, and he spends his nights volunteering at the train station to help other refugees. So the stories are absolutely amazing. But it also forces us to reconsider, what is this whole mass movement of peoples? You know, why do we think that a refugee is so different from an economic migrant? You know, why is it that the Swedish government is letting in anyone who comes from Syria, even though not all of them were under immediate threat of death, while EU migrants, as they call them, basically Roma coming from Hungary or Romania, are being kicked out, you know, because they're only, quote-unquote, economic migrants. But of course, they are there because of policies and neoliberalism and changes in the world economy and the European economy that have, you know, made it impossible for them to have a normal life where they came from. So, you know, we need to really reconceptualize this idea that there's a difference, such a basic difference between economic and war-related migration. And of course, in America, it's the same thing. The millions of people coming from Central America who Donald Trump wants to kick out. You know, most of them come because their economies were decimated by U.S. policies and U.S. wars, or U.S.-sponsored wars, which we put billions of dollars in and led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. And, you know, we have a responsibility to these people who then come to us because we destroyed their economy. So, again, we really need, whether it's in Europe or in the U.S., we need to reevaluate and come to a new understanding of what it means to be a migrant or a refugee. And this is, you know, really the cost and the reality of neoliberalism in the real world in the beginning of the 21st century. So that, I think, is a message that, you know, obviously politicians will not deal with, but on the ground we have to deal with it, and we have to come to terms with it as a country here and as a continent in Europe.
Well, Mark Levine, what a pleasure it is to have you back on the program.
Always happy to be with you.
And I'd love to continue this part of the conversation in a coming week as well, because there's obviously so much there. So thank you
so much.
Well,
I have, you know, my next Al Jazeera column will deal with this. So perhaps we can do that when it comes out.
Great. Thank you again.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, rethinking the past to shape the future. Stay tuned.
Ay duniya, ye duniya badi gol hai. Ay duniya, hai isme kitne chhol. Galiyo galiyo, chappa chappa, ablam chaplam laare lappa, toba toba rabba rabba, ji 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 ji.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What we remember about historical events and how we remember them affect the future of politics and policies, according to our next scholars. And memory entrepreneurs are in the business of shaping these memories as a means of advancing political agendas. How is it happening right now? With us are two experts. Dovile Budrite is a professor of political science at Georgia Gwinnett College, the author of Taming Nationalism, and co-editor of the collected volume Memory and Trauma, in international relations. Douglas Becker also joins us. He's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California and author of the chapter Memory and Trauma as Elements of Identity in Foreign Policy Making. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you back again. I want to start with this concept of memory politics itself and what exactly we mean by memory politics. Dovile, perhaps you can start us.
So I would probably talk briefly about memory entrepreneurs, and that would be a very special group of people who actually try to translate traumatic memories into power. And this is very much the focus of their agendas. And I would define memory politics in a sense, maybe using even the traditional definition of politics, who gets what, how, and why, and basically saying that memory politics is primarily about instrumentalization of the past. So that would be one way to look at it.
So in essence, what we're saying is it's trying to shape how we, as a global community or individual communities, remember the past, what we remember and how we remember it, as a means of then shaping the future.
That's right.
Doug Becker, what would you add?
For me, there's two key areas where memory plays a substantial role. You know, how the past influences contemporary politics, or what I'll frequently will say that sort of the use of the past for contemporary political purposes. One is identity, that as a lens through which political actors, people, political figures view issues, view interests, are viewed through the lens of the past. So how do they conceptualize themselves and how do they conceptualize opponents as being either, you know, friends or adversaries, of being liberal or illiberal, democratic or undemocratic, aggressive or passive, et cetera. The other is what I call alternative legitimation discourses, which is you can't make a legal argument, or you have a fairly weak legal argument for a certain policy. So instead, you'll cite some sort of historical grievance. And so it becomes an alternative form of legitimating an action. The latter is much more instrumentalist, what Bile had just said, or much more of a kind of a public relations, a way to justify an action. The former is much more ingrained, that our identities are best, I think, viewed as a lens through which it influences our interests, that influence our policy preferences. And so just how much memory influences how we view the world versus how we're going to sell a policy. I think both are present. I think they vary from case to case. And to me, those are the two most important ways in which memory influences contemporary politics.
Let's see if we can grab some examples from the current political stage. Doug, you and I exchanged some emails about some of them.
Right. One of them that I'll start with, as a way to kind of throw a lob to Dovile, is the way in which post-Soviet politics and potential conflict areas are being influenced by memory questions. Specifically, examining Vladimir Putin's speech to the Duma as justification for the Russian annexation of Crimea is filled with references to historical memory. Questions about the importance of Crimea to the Russians, the importance to the city of Sevastopol, the city of glory, the fact that Crimeans are Russians, a point that is pretty hotly contested by historians and political actors alike as to who exactly are the natives of Crimea. And even most importantly, this anti-communist narrative that it was the communist leadership, both Stalin's decisions vis-a-vis the Ukrainians, most notably the Battle of Kiev and using Ukrainians as a kind of shield to slow the German advance, and then Khrushchev giving Crimea to the Ukrainians as a kind of apology for how the communist state had treated Ukrainians, a point that Putin would be quick to point out that Khrushchev had no right to do. And so therefore, Crimea has always been Russian. The fact that it was a part of Ukraine as a result of the breakup of the Soviet Union should be irrelevant. And therefore, the alternative legitimation discourse of the Russians saying, no matter what international law might say about annexing territory that belongs to another sovereign territory, Crimea is Russian. And it should be Russian.
How would you say this is different from, say, lying about the past to shape beliefs?
First of all, I don't like to use the...
The lie word?
Yeah, use the word lying, because these historical narratives are at least contested and contestable. And so I'm not sure that Putin's citation of whether Crimea, you know, has been a part of Russia, I'm not ready to call it a lie per se, but it certainly is creating alternative historical discourses that I want to stress to you, President Putin can make whatever argument that he wants to make. It has to resonate with the Russian population. And so this is not a fabricated discourse, a fabricated narrative, because the Russians very much are responding to Putin's arguments. Europeans, Americans, certainly Ukrainians are rejecting it, but Russians are certainly responding, and you're seeing it, you know, in very real form with improvements in public approval ratings, at least when asked the question, should Russia have annexed Crimea? The numbers are overwhelmingly in favor, you know, on the part of Russians.
Dovile, how would you respond to all this?
I would say that whenever we talk about memory, we also need to talk about forgetting, and also, especially I think in the case of Russia, strategic forgetting. Because I think one narrative in particular that I would like to bring to the table would be the narrative of Crimean Tatars. And indeed, the story of their trauma that interestingly somehow got lost during the Crimean crisis and indeed is a rarely remembered, right? Deportation of Crimean Tatars. So one could argue that the narrative that was constructed by Putin, right, definitely very strategically took out certain identities, certain people, their memories, and also took out indeed the fact that many of them do feel very, very intimately linked to the Crimea. So what I would like to add to that story, again, I think in the case of Russia, but also in the case of many other states where we see politicians using memory for aggressive behavior, right? I mean, I think we see this very interesting interaction between strategic forgetting and also instrumentalization of memory. So I think very often it should be the duty of critically thinking people, scholars, students, everybody else, to actually ask the question, what exactly is being obscured? What is it that's missing from this narrative that's being put forward for public consumption? And just one more quick point. I think Doug's point about the audience is actually crucial. I think it's an excellent point. And I think when we do take a case of memory instrumentalization, in this particular case, obviously, Putin saying that the Crimea, quote-unquote, always belonged to us, right? I think it's very, very important also to ask the question, to whom is this narrative addressed and why and how? And obviously, if we take a counter-narrative, right, somebody could argue, well, look, how about the narrative of Tatars, right? Mm-hmm. How about the history going back to the Ottoman Empire, etc., where... who lived there, right? What about the stories of these people? So I think it's very important to also ask these additional questions about strategic forgetting and also who's in the audience.
You know, it's interesting, a couple of the things that you wrote about in the introduction to this book that you co-edited, one pertained to trauma itself, the trauma drama you talked about. Mm-hmm. And obviously trauma is something that is very shared across many different groups of people. It transcends time, it transcends space, and yet there are these sort of individual traumas and stories of traumas that end up competing rather than uniting. I suppose this is what you're talking about when you're talking about memory production and using it for political gain rather than as a means of uniting people.
Thank you for the question. And indeed, I think that when Erica Resende and I, when we were thinking about the framework for our book, and that was a while ago, we worked with it starting with, I believe, 2011, 2012. At that point, I think the framework for analysis was about competition, right? So it's a framework that's very well known for political scientists. Again, memory to be used for gaining power. And many chapters that are written for that book and also in the field of memory studies indeed are written with this framework of competitive memories in mind. But I think what's happening right now in the field of memory studies, and slowly it's entering even political science, I believe, and international studies, is a different way of thinking about memory. And this way of thinking is based on Michael Rodberg's theory of multi-directional memory. And it's counterintuitive thinking. It's basically a proposition that it's possible to find ways to feel somebody else's pain, to identify with somebody else's pain instead of trying to establish this competitive relationship. So I'd like to give a specific example, I think, of very interesting and promising work. Right now, Erica and I, we actually edited a special issue of ethnicity studies or Etniškumo studijos in Lithuania, and one article which was written by Violeta Dovulute can explain this multi-directional memory. So she wrote about the ways in which Lithuania's Jews, who were deported in 1941, remember their deportations. And 1941, this was the time when large numbers of Lithuanians, Jews, Belarusians, Polish people were deported from Lithuania. That was the beginning of the Soviet rule. And then, of course, the Nazi rule started. In her work, she actually looks at the ways in which Lithuania's Jews remember 1941 and those deportations. And this, I believe, she establishes this very useful relationship of multidirectional memory to think about these relationships instead of actually, again, competing and having this competing victimhoods that, unfortunately, in the past very much was in Jewish-Lithuanian relations.
It's reminiscent of a BBC where people are competing for the worst childhoods.
But it's also, sorry, important to kind of think about the opposite, that living in that, having that maybe not such a great experience does not necessarily have to be the reason for competition, but it also can be a reason for a different kind of relationship.
Yes.
Kind of feeling somebody else's pain, relating to somebody else's pain.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, you used a few phrases and terms in that piece. One of them was hauntology.
It's used by Jessica Auchter, also I think very promising scholars in memory studies. And it was also used in the past in studies of Russian memory by Alexander Etkin. And Alexander Etkin, the way he uses that term, he says, look, what's going on in Russia right now is that we have this really strange warped memory when many bodies of people who died from war, from various other disasters, are still not buried. So there was no proper mourning. And for him, this is also a huge problem. I mean, it's kind of unfinished process of mourning. The country cannot come to terms with its past. And what Jessica is doing in her piece, again, for this Journal of Ethnicity Studies, she's actually taking the same problem. She's comparing a case of Sudan with a case of Rwanda and saying, look, even in the case of Sudan, many bodies were not buried. But nevertheless, knowing that, knowing about the tragedy of somebody else, right, can be a way to relate to that tragedy. It can also basically make us think about our vulnerability as humankind. So it's just, I think, a very interesting, original way to think about these issues.
And specifically with the hauntology, the idea of having not properly mourned, it's almost as if the dead are still living among us. I think that's one of the ways that you wrote about it, so that it is still haunting us and it interfering with our getting on with life.
Or again, not necessarily thinking in terms of, again, negative emotions, but it's possible to also think in terms of, as Jessica Auchter suggests, our global vulnerabilities, being able to relate to other human beings and their lives and their pains. And that's also one way of thinking about it.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the politics of memory. One other concept that I wanted to ask you about before we get into more specific examples, especially with the political terrain today, deals with post-memory, which, and there's a whole new movement of study in this area now, I know, which is memory passed on to the next generation. And one of the authors in your edited volume was Hirsch arguing that there must be affiliative structures. What does that mean?
Indeed, it's a great question, and it's also, I think, very interesting work which is being done when it comes to post-memory. Marianne Hirsch, she's a literary scholar, and she came up with that concept to try to come to terms with her own experience as somebody who has relatives who have suffered from the Holocaust. So she developed, I think, this very promising way of thinking about production of memory, continuity of memory, right? When people who have experienced trauma firsthand die, what happens to their memories? How are they preserved? And also, obviously, there's a huge number of various issues that come with that, right? And that's where I believe this concept of cultural work comes in, because again, for trauma to continue, in a sense, for trauma work to be done, somebody must come up with mechanisms of transmission so that people who have not experienced trauma firsthand are able to come close to it. So I think that this is, again, this is a very interesting framework of thinking about trauma, and it's being applied definitely outside of literary studies. It's being applied also in studying, say, transmission of trauma in other frameworks, not necessarily just the Holocaust, but also other traumas. I think it raises many, many interesting issues. What characteristics does successful memory entrepreneurship have, right? When are we as individuals able to relate to trauma that happened a long time ago? I personally believe that individual story and testimonies actually matter a lot in that work of transmission. And also, again, it matters. I think it's very, very important to keep in mind also the ethics of transmission, how to make sure that those memories are not instrumentalized, are not misrepresented, that Doug was talking about in the beginning of this program.
Let's turn to that. Doug, let's bring you back in here about this instrumentalization, or, you know, the use of memory to advance political policies, foreign policies. That's specifically what you have been looking at. There are a couple of examples that you wrote about in that chapter. One pertained to Australia. How did you see Australia as trying to shape memory to advance a policy?
At one level, what the Australians had been wrestling with for years, of course, the Australian foundational myths would best be described as we call a white settler narrative, with invisibility of Indigenous persons and the notion that as they sweep across the continent, there's a certain modernization, a certain development that leave out the Indigenous persons. Australia has, over the course of the last 20, 25 years, started to really come to grips with the memory of the Indigenous persons, really culminating in the government's apology for genocide, based specifically on the transferring of Native children to white families and raising them as whites. One of the ironies of this is that, first of all, has had a profound influence on what we think of as genocide. You can actually make the argument that materially those children may have been better served by being raised in white families, in the sense that they're being raised as they were wealthier, had access to schools, and you know, as a form of assimilation. But it destroyed their culture. And the destruction of culture as genocide, as opposed to genocide simply meaning a lot of killing, I think was profoundly influenced by Australia's decision to apologize for genocide. It certainly has spurred other states, the Canadians, for example, to take much more seriously their responsibility in traumas against Indigenous persons, First Nations, and Indigenous in Canada. And so what it's done in a real sort of practical, meaningful way for Australians, I think, is advanced image internationally of Australia as being able to speak authoritatively not just about Indigenous rights, but about reconciliation. And so in that case, there is a political currency that's attached to the apology. Ilya Barkan's work, The Guilt of Nations, goes into detail as to why states might choose to apologize and what sort of benefits they might get. But one of those benefits is that ability to then speak authoritatively on the memories of trauma and to be able to advance certain arguments, putting Australia in the same camp as states like Germany, where the German government has absolutely fostered in a meaningful way a leadership role in being able to speak about the pain, the trauma of military aggression, even of genocide, as a perpetrator, but as a perpetrator that's acknowledged their role. And so it's not always about aggression. It's certainly, there may be a degree of contestation, or it may be about advancing a certain narrative, but that narrative being about reconciliation, about peace.
Well, one of the other aspects of Australian memory production pertained also to its involvement in Indonesia, you wrote.
Oh, absolutely. And in part, I think the fact that Indonesia has been wrestling with identity questions, the apology for genocide, et cetera, has given it the kind of currency that when it chooses to threaten military intervention without Indonesia's authorization, without Indonesia's permission, following the genocide as a result of East Timor's vote for independence, that Australians were generally not seen in most of the international community as acting in a militarily aggressive way, that they're taking advantage of Indonesia's weakness to seize part of Indonesia. That I'm always reminded when I would ask in my class, why was Australia not seen as an aggressor? And a student said, but Australians don't act that way. Australians don't invade other countries. And it got me thinking, in part because of the way Australia has crafted its image, its identity based on its historical memory, that the way we view Australians is just different than other countries that haven't acknowledged it.
So what you're saying is it has used history to create an image about who Australia and Australians are, and that image then permits them to enact particular foreign policies that may or may not be aligned with that, but we interpret them in that way.
Right, or at least the one thing I want to caution against is that any of these narratives are somehow fixed. That one of the things that fascinates me about memory research, I think fascinates all memory researchers, is just how flexible, just how evolving these memories always seem to be. The Australians advancing, this argument, or I know with you in Auckland, you've been wrestling with precisely a historical memory question about the role of the Maori within New Zealand society. That has shifted, where at times the New Zealand's government, like the Australians, have seemed to advance a narrative that we understand how best to treat Indigenous peoples, that we've identified the rights of the Indigenous, but I don't want to describe it as any sort of settled narrative. It's an ongoing political drama where the memories can get interpreted and reinterpreted, but even more importantly, the memory might get interpreted and reinterpreted, but the policies that would necessarily follow from those memories are constantly being interpreted and reinterpreted. So yeah, I mean, it does help to create space, but it's not as though we are now fixed in time where Australia gets the right to invade whoever they want and simply say, but we're good people. That instead, it creates a space that other states may not have, but it needs to constantly be fostered and constantly advanced.
Dovile, let's bring you back in.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something to Doug's story. I think a couple of points. And point number one, I think right now we probably can start talking about responsible sovereignty when, again, for a nation state, for a lack of a better term, or just the state. I mean, nation state is probably an outdated term right now, but for a state to be accepted into the international community is extremely important to accept responsibility for the past. And that's I think, definitely could be argued that it's part of responsible sovereignty. And also another point that I would like to make, the second point, I think it's also very, very important to remember, again, historical facts and historical truths, because when we make comparisons, I think it's really, really important also to keep in mind the differences between different genocides and different traumas. And that's also, again, when thinking about Australians and their past, probably sometimes I believe that it's not always appropriate even to make comparisons, let's say, with Germany. So my point here would be that perhaps what unites all of these cases would be responsibility, responsible sovereignty, but also there are important differences as well.
There's one last question I'd like to ask, and that is something else that, Davila, you've written about, which is the role of media today. And so I'd like for you to address that, because there's a couple of ways. One is that most of mass media is under control of some powerful entity, whether it's a state or whether it's a corporation. It's changing a little bit with the internet, but not by miles. So what is the role of media in all of this?
That's a great question. That's also, I think, a very difficult question. I think definitely the 21st century, we definitely are seeing many diverse media channels and media agents, if you will, and I think it's great. I think it's also, there's power, let's say, in using Facebook, there's power in using Twitter and all these other tools. I think that definitely empowers individuals and it helps, again, to tell their story. But also, I think what's very true in the 21st century is that sometimes it's possible to project lies, to lie with pictures, to lie with images. So I think another important point to remember would be to very much, it's so important to think critically. Because I think very much what we are seeing, especially when we're dealing with trauma, especially when we're dealing with the past, there are many actors, again, who will go an extra mile to construct the story of the past that they want by increasing the number of victims, by showing false pictures, et cetera, et cetera. So what I would like to say about, again, the role of the media, I think that we definitely can get 21st century many more news than in the past. But at the same time, it becomes extremely, extremely important to maintain, shall I say, constantly thinking critically, constantly questioning what we are seeing. And that's where, again, that's where knowing of history, that's where, again, simple liberal arts knowledge can be very, very useful, right? Let's study political science. Let's study history. Let's study international relations, right? That will help us to understand much better what's going on and who's trying to instrumentalize what.
Wonderful to have both of you back here on the Scholar Circle. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Davila Budrite is a professor of political science at Georgia Gwinnett College, the author of Taming Nationalism, and co-editor of the collected volume Memory and Trauma in International Relations. Douglas Becker is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California and author of the chapter Memory and Trauma as Elements of Identity in Foreign Policy Making. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week. Choli chupke chupke gudgudadi.